since 2003, there's been approximately 2,600 animal food recalls, with over 50% of them identified as class one recalls, which are recalls where there is a high severity of negative outcomes with animals or people eating those animal products. So we had 12 in 2023. That was a high after we usually average between 4 and 8 a year, but they tend to be fairly high impact. And we can talk about that as we move forward in this discussion. But so do they happen a lot? No, but when they do happen, they tend to be very disruptive, expensive, and impactful.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/ag. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the Feed Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I am Wilmer Pacheco. I am an extension specialist and associate professor in the Department of Poultry Science at Auburn University. We are dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions in the feed industry, so get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episode. And today, I'm joined by Gretchen Mocher, a recognized expert in food safety with extensive experience in regulatory compliance, risk management, and supply chain oversight. Dr. Mocher has worked closely with industry and regulatory agencies to improve recalls preparedness and strengthen preventive control systems, particularly under the framework of the Food Safety Modernization Act. Her work focuses on helping companies navigate complex safety challenges while protecting both animals and public health. And in this episode, we will be discussing ingredient recalls and what they mean to the feed industry. Hello, Gretchen. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us. And for the ones who don't know you, could you share a little bit about your professional experience?
Indeed. It's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Gretchen Mocher. I am a professor in ag and biosystems engineering at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. My research expertise involves post-harvest of grain ingredients, grain and feed ingredients, particularly corn and soybeans, but we work a little in wheat and barley and other ingredients, both testing, risk analysis, measurement science, and traceability, all wrapped into that umbrella of management. So glad to be here today and look forward to talking about recalls, which are definitely part of risk management.
Thank you, Gretchen. And you know, like when I think about recalls, I typically think about like feed recalls. But I mean, today we're going to be discussing ingredient recalls. So the first question that I have for you is, how often are feed ingredients recalled? And has that frequency changed over the years?
Animal food recalls do not happen as often as human food recalls do. That is true. But since 2018, we have had 36 that we counted, and that figure comes from November of 25. Since then, we've had probably two or three big ones and a variety of little ones. When you count pet food, a researcher completed a paper, it wasn't me, but it was someone else that said since 2003, there's been approximately 2,600 animal food recalls, with over 50% of them identified as class one recalls, which are recalls where there is a high severity of negative outcomes with animals or people eating those animal products. So we had 12 in 2023. That was a high after we usually average between 4 and 8 a year, but they tend to be fairly high impact. And we can talk about that as we move forward in this discussion. But so do they happen a lot? No, but when they do happen, they tend to be very disruptive, expensive, and impactful.
Evonik Animal Nutrition is committed to ensure food security and safety while reducing the ecological footprint of animal farming. Its products and services use evidence-based solutions that seek to promote animal welfare and reduce reliance on natural resources. All this is underpinned by long-standing industry partnerships and deep customer understanding. Evonik's focus on efficiency, sustainable, healthy nutrition, and collaborations with livestock farming partners creates value for customers and consumers.
Excellent. And what are the most frequent root causes of those ingredient recalls? Are they related to contamination, labeling, or supply chain issues?
All of the above, I would say. Certainly, there's always contamination, and our number one contamination agent is the various forms of salmonella. Salmonella is difficult to contain, and it is everywhere, right? It gets into things and it is difficult to get it out once it's within a conveyance instrument or something like that as you're processing and producing that feed. But the other thing, as you mentioned, is the labeling. Sometimes things are labeled incorrectly or something gets in to something that shouldn't be. You know, if you have a restricted ingredient or an ingredient that is going to one animal species and it shouldn't be, those recalls, and sometimes the recalls are especially impactful in the fall of 24. There was an incident where I think 50 plus rodeo horses were killed because an ingredient was not to be in the horse feed, and it was. So things like that, and by then the recall is really too little, too late, right? We've already had a severe adverse effect with the animals, so. Labeling and contamination during processing are two of the primary causal factors, but also human error. People dump the wrong ingredient into the wrong feed mixture, and once it's in there, it's hard to retrieve. It's impossible to retrieve generally, and sometimes they don't even know that they did that until after the outcomes become clear, right? So those are the three primary things. But I also would say there's not very much literature on this. And so these are things that we don't have a good handle on, only from the surveillance done by the Food and Drug Administration, and in some cases, the USDA.
Okay. I would say almost all the companies now, you know, they are complying with the Food Safety Modernization Act with FSMA. And how does FSMA has changed, you know, like the way that companies approach recalls?
I think FSMA has definitely changed the way companies approach the recall. But I would say even before that, the Bioterrorism Act was really the first legislative body that required or even talked about this idea that when something needs to come off the market out of commerce, how does that look? And what does that look like in the animal food industry, with the understanding that animal food doesn't generally have a marker on it, particularly when it's in bulk. And it is difficult to contain. And that's what makes it challenging. The Food Safety Modernization Act added the preventative controls component, which when a firm has a preventive control, of course, they need to have a recall plan in place. I think it is true, and I think I'm not the only person that believes this. I think this is widely held belief and understanding that you don't need to have a preventive control to have a recall plan. It's a good practice, even when there are no preventive controls identified. So it has changed. I think it has been brought to a higher level of attention among those that handle and produce feed and post-harvest ingredient uses for other grain ingredients. So I think it's definitely on the radar at a higher level than it used to be.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Like, I mean, even though like some companies, they don't require to have a recall because during the hazard analysis, they didn't find any hazard that requires a preventive control. It is very important that they do have like a recall plan in place.
For
yeah.
Sure. Yes, mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with that. Yeah.
And, you know, like for those companies that have like a recalls plans, what do you think that are the best practices for preparing for a recall? And how, you know, can companies proactively reduce the likelihood of a recall occurring?
Well, I think one of the best positions for a company to be in a recall is to be able to say with near 100% certainty, that material you're recalling, we don't have any product in that bulk mode, right? We're not there. Our stuff is not there. Our product is not part of that shipment. Mm-hmm. But to do that, it is about record keeping. Right. It is about mm-hmm. where things come from, where they're held on site, how they are mixed on site, and then where they go next. And it is challenging. And I could talk a whole episode about inventory management, so I'm not going to mm-hmm. talk about that today. Mm-hmm. But that is a critical success factor, I would say, in managing recalls preemptively preventing them before they actually begin. Because when you have that, when you have that inventory management, it helps you in two ways. One, it helps you to say, this is not our problem. This is not our product. But the second thing, if it is your product, you could say, okay, this product is safe. This product is not. So let's recall the unsafe product, get it out of commerce. Potentially, in some cases, we can reuse it in a less sensitive audience or re-divert it into another use. Mm-hmm. So it's not always a matter of dumping the product, right? I think we often think of that when we think of recalls, but that's not always necessary. Sometimes you can divert it to a less sensitive end use, for example. So I think those are some best practices.
Yeah. And like you were saying too, like maybe like when you were talking about the horse feed, I will imagine that was probably Monensin, right?
Yes,
typically. And also like probably like don't use, let's say if they are producing like broiler feed, and broiler feeds we use Monensin without any problems, but maybe don't produce a horse feed in the same feed mill or just have like flushing and
sequencing and
yeah.
flushing, put that in place. Yeah, those are some good preventative practices as well.
Yeah. And you know, like another thing, I'm talking about like ingredient recalls, you were discussing like probably the ingredients, one factor is salmonella, right? Especially when we are working with pet foods. And so what can the feed mills do in the supplier risk management? How can they evaluate the risk of their suppliers?
I think clearly there are some steps to take to protect themselves from unscrupulous behavior or unsafe behavior from suppliers. But my first suggestion would be to take a sample, right? To take a composite sample, potentially a little bit of, if you have multiple loads coming in, take a little bit of each. And you may not even need to test it unless there is a problem, right? Label it, hold it until you know that product is okay and is safe. It might not be any more than a week at a time, and have kind of a system to roll those out, right? Once you know that things have made it through the supply chain without an issue, let it, you know, but to have a record keeping system and to be able to test if necessary, both to release yourself from guilt as well as to say, okay, is this ours, to confirm this is our product, we will take action. And so that is definitely something I would put in place. I would also have a conversation with the supplier about those flushing, sequencing actions that they are doing at their facility. I don't think it would be outrageous to walk through their processing center.
Yes. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. to watch and observe what they are doing, ask them questions about how they are mitigating the food safety hazards, including salmonella.
Yeah.
I don't think that would be outrageous, and potentially to sketch out a process flow diagram or something to let them know and let you know where, if there's going to be a problem, where would it most likely happen, right? And really target the efforts and mitigation on those areas with the understanding that it's not that things can't happen in other parts of the process, but generally to follow the 80-20, you know, 80% of the problems caused by 20% of the issues. That's the same with the process, right? There's going to be just a small part of the process that probably the majority of cross-contamination, if it occurs, will happen.
Yes, I agree.
Take the product coming in, test the sample, have a testing plan in place, and then be familiar and familiarize yourself with their process are three things that I would recommend.
And I will imagine like it also, it is influenced to where in the process that product enters too, right? Because you are going to have like some products that are going to go in the mixer and then they will go like through thermal processing. Exactly. If you are controlling salmonella, you might have like a process control there. But then you might also have products that enter, you know, like after the thermal processing, and those ones are going to be more critical. Yeah.
If there is no heat being processed or heat process step happening afterwards, absolutely. Keeping a handle on what's being added and the controls that are in place for that ingredient are also important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is another, I don't know, like how much experience do you have in this area or if you see that happening, but like salmonella in, let's say in fats, is that something that is common? Because sometimes we, like, let's say we can apply fat post pellet, for example, or post extrusion. Is like a problem?
I don't have a lot of research experience in this, but I would guess if I had to hypothesize on this, you know, fat soluble things move slowly to mm-hmm. to get out, right? To wash them yeah. out. Unlike water based vitamins, minerals, things, you can't just take the water and wash it out. With fat soluble things, they're kind of stuck in the fat for a while. It is difficult to release them. And so it adds that, I would definitely say it adds a hazard. I don't know a number in terms of what's the percentage increase.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question though. And I think it is, I have never seen any body of literature, peer reviewed or otherwise, that talks about that, but it's an excellent question.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like, let's say, you know, companies, we are trying to avoid recalls, right? Even, you know, checking the ingredients. So let's say we have to do a recall. And I mean, we have to do it. There was a product that we need to bring back. What are the best practices for communicating recalls to regulators, to customers and stakeholders without causing unnecessary panic?
Yes. Well, certainly, it's not a good day when you have a recall, right? Recalls are never planned, and they often occur right when you don't want them to, right? The Friday before a holiday weekend or something like that. That's when they often occur. Not always, but it seems like it, right? It's never in a convenient place. I think the first thing to think about is what researchers often call food safety or food recall diagnosis. So they answer three questions. What's the product involved? You know, what are we talking about here? Where's the problem? What's the scope? And then the traceability, like, can we reach back and draw these things back in? And to do that, I think best practice would be to have a plan in place beforehand. And I know that people are going to say, well, this is not critical, right? But I think the success planning from the beginning will mitigate the damage. A couple of other things. So to have a committee where you could say, this is who's going to do what if we have a recall. Have one spokesperson. Agree yes. on the messaging and don't let your employees talk to the media, right?
Yeah.
If an event happens and it's an impactful event, people are going to be calling. They're going to try and find every source that they can to talk to somebody to give them a scoop, right? I think it's important to first communicate internally with your employees and say, we're going to release a statement. Don't talk to anybody, please. And expect them to follow that. That timely communication, you know, this is not something that you can mull over and think about and methodically put together. You need to kind of have a template, I would say, to say, this is what has happened. Here's what we're doing about it. Here's the impact to animals and to people. And I think those are things that make the problem, I'm not going to say it makes it go away because it doesn't, but it does lower that panic level among the population that is impacted. And then finally, to prepare for these things, because as I said, they never happen when you expect them to. They never happen at 10 o'clock on Monday, right? They happen when you don't want them to. So I think it's helpful to run mock recalls periodically and to put in place, you know, put the call out, say, we're trying to find this load that came in on this day, and provide limited information to the employees and determine whether they can find it and isolate it in the 24 hours that they are required by bioterrorism and by FSMA. And that is a good test of the inventory management of a firm and a good practice for when it does happen. You can be then prepared, have your people in place, and first of all, see if you can recall the product that is in question. But number two, I don't think it's outrageous to run a communication mock recall as well. Who's going to be communicated with? How's that chain going to go? Is it going to be the CEO that does the talking? Is it going to be an operations person? Who's going to be the person standing in front of the camera making the statement? And how much information is going to be released? Those are conversations that ideally should happen before an event. If the event is happening and that's when you're having the conversation, work the problem. Don't try to make it worse by guessing. You know, work with as much data as you have. And first job is to quarantine the product. Second is to communicate with your own employees. And then the third is to communicate with those impacted, those who have animals, those who have people who are impacted. And I think it's important to recognize, you know, the priorities here. Get the product unsafe off the market, communicate with your people, then communicate with external parties. And all of the processes that go into that should contribute to one of those three aspects, from my perspective.
Yeah. And something that you are bringing up that I think is extremely important is like the recall team, right? It's good to have a recall team. Is there like a minimum number of people that needs to be like in this recall team, or like what do you think is the right number of people? And you also were discussing like mock recalls. And mock recalls, should they be done once a year or more often if needed?
I think in both cases, my answer would say it depends, right? A small facility, three people is a lot of people for a small facility. But for a larger facility, even with as many as 25 or 30 employees, I don't think it's outrageous to have three people on a team. Three is a nice number because if one is sick or one is out on vacation or something like that, and something happens, you still have two people to work the event. But I also think it provides, and they should come from different areas of the operation. They shouldn't all be from operations. One should be from operations. You probably should have somebody who has some expertise in working with the public if you have a large enough facility. If you do not, potentially develop a relationship with your local media so that when you call them, they will be willing to potentially give you the benefit of the doubt rather than framing the story negatively from the beginning. That relationship also happens ahead of time. I could, again, talk a whole class on media relations, and that's not where I plan to go, but those things are important. And potentially somebody from administration, that, you know, the buck stops at the administration, right? The buck stops at the top, and you should have somebody on that executive team that is also on your recall team, because they will be able to see the whole picture, in my opinion. To your question about how often, I would say it depends on how much product you're moving and what the hazard is. I would say at minimum once a year, but I don't think it would be outrageous even on a quarterly basis, or for some facilities, particularly multi-species facilities where they have a lot of product flowing through, right? Where they're making product for horses and sheep and cattle and swine and chickens. And poultry, I think it would not be outrageous to have one even once a month, because you have so many potential hazardous mixtures that could occur, right? I think it is, and I think the preventive controls and the hazards and the end use that is serviced all can contribute to how many a month, and take a look at how much product can you lose and still make money, right, in a year. I mean, because the economic implications, I mean, we've seen firms, pretty large firms, go out of business because of poorly handled recalls situations related to food and feed ingredients. So it is not something to be brushed off, right?
No, and I agree. And this is my second from the last question is like, you know, after a recall, what are some critical success factors that determine whether a company handles a recall effectively?
So success factors, you said after or before? After?
No, after. How do you basically know if you did a good job with that recall, basically?
Of course. Some indicators would be if people buy your product again. I think that's probably the number one indicator. If people are willing to come back and trust you, buy your product, it wouldn't help to have a good press story. It wouldn't hurt to have a good press story to say, we fixed this problem. It was an isolated incident. We've got it controlled. All the contaminated product is contained, and to put a press release out of something like that. But other things, the number of animals impacted is clearly a lagging indicator on whether you were successful, but also what your employees say. You know, I think it is good to have potentially a debrief on with your people who have worked with this product and say a little bit of like an almost in a safety sense, an incident investigation. What happened? What can we do to prevent it the next time? And how can we learn from this? And how can we keep it from happening again? Essentially a root cause analysis on the incident to determine what happened here. And determine where are these things? Do we have some indicators ahead of time that would have suggested that this was going to happen? How can we close that loop and eliminate those things? Or should be the kind of conversations you're having after a recall. I think one thing that you should not probably do is say, well, this happened this time, but it's not going to happen again. If you don't make any changes, it will most certainly happen again. And whether that means changes, I think you should be assessing your vendor and your ingredient suppliers. I think you should be assessing your systems and your processes and ensure that your employees are trained appropriately to handle corrective actions that are necessary to prevent this type of event, which is expensive and disruptive for all involved. And hopefully you're not killing people or animals, but that is, of course, the worst case.
Yes. And you know, now, you know, like just to finish up and looking ahead with advancements in technology, like, you know, like more rapid testing or more like now companies using a digital traceability. How do you see recalls prevention and response evolving in the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years?
I think there are a lot of opportunities to improve the processes already in place. So rapid testing would really be a saver, right, in terms of time. If we had a real-time test that could test at the scale, excuse me, or something like that, right, to be able to scan it, computer vision types of testing, things that would be able to say, this is good, this is not good, with a composite sample or a wagon load or a semi-load of product. I think we're a ways away from that, but I don't think that's outrageous in terms of what could happen eventually, right? That would really help us in our ability, because one of the biggest problems we have in grain and feed ingredients is there's so much of it, right? There's so much stuff. It is almost impossible to sample all of it. And the problem of sampling is a whole nother discussion. And I think I actually talked with you all about this earlier. That I think technology would certainly contribute to resolving some of the issues that we have with sampling and potentially sampling of a homogeneous bulk material like grain and feed ingredients. I think technology will certainly contribute to advancements in those areas. Absolutely. I have no doubt.
Yeah, and also, you know, like now I see with the companies that we just get like a lot of records, right? So if we have like some process controls in place, and then we can collect records in, you know, every 3 seconds if we want, we can go, you know, like check the records, and everything is in the system. Yeah.
But I would also add, and I, one of my former colleagues said this once when he was talking about sampling. He said, if you are going to collect all of that data and don't use it, you might as well put a pile of money on the floor and light it on fire.
Yeah.
And so my advice, when you're right, there's a whole bunch of data, finding effective ways, effective and quick ways, I would say, to summarize and provide a synopsis of what that data are telling you is a critical part of the data system, right? Is to be able to use the data to make better decisions about your product. And that's really the bottom line.
Yeah, yeah. And also what I have seen from like the FISMA perspective is like you can just generate records when something is like was no in compliance to those records. I think are also easy to review.
And you're required to review them as the preventive control qualified individual. Yeah, the PCQI is required every 7 work days or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, that concludes another episode of the Fit Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to stay updated on future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a comment. Thank you, Gretchen, and thanks, everyone, for listening. And I hope all of you have a blessed day.
Thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.